609 in the Twin Cities, 8 degrees. Hey, it's just been a long day, hasn't it, Jonathan? Why, wonderful producer Jonathan Lowe here.
They all blur together. They're all long days. I apologize, folks, for right there. We weren't on dead air. It was just operator error.
It has been a long day. And gosh, I just felt like it got longer listening to Sloan, who's so wonderful and so nice and so charming, read that brutal forecast. Oh, my goodness. We were chatting just in the break that my daughter and her friends are really hoping for a cold day, which does not happen that often here in Minnesota. But I do think that there is, if it gets down to this minus 40 wind chills, I really think it's unreasonable to have kids going to school. And it's not just the little kids, but, you know, I've got an older high school kid. I just think, you know, you think about kids driving or something going wrong or just it's just not safe. It's just and why do it? Well, let's just keep people home.
It's as adults, you know, you expect to brave it. You expect to go out. You expect to go to work. But again, when you have kids that are growing, their bodies are still growing.
Yeah.
You don't want to put them out on a bus stop. You don't want to have them, like you said, out in rural Minnesota, out in outstate, where they may have to drive 10, 15 miles to get to school, and then they break down, and then what do you do then? And it's 25 right. below outside?
Right. And, you know, even today I had an experience where I was driving on Highway 7. I was trying to get to my daughter's hockey game in Victoria, and I don't know if it's an older car. The transmission must have blown or whatever. Suddenly I wasn't going anywhere, and I couldn't even get the car. I could get it to the side of the road, but I couldn't really get it really on the shoulder. And people were just blowing by me really fast. So I called AAA. They said that a tow truck would be more than 2 hours. And then the police, though, because I was basically in the road, they said I was a hazard. And so they called another tow truck company, and so I've got to get reimbursed for AAA. But anyway, all I could think of was, you know, at least it wasn't – it was cold, but it wasn't minus 40 wind chill.
Yeah.
And it wasn't at night. You know, it just – I was like, ugh.
And you talk about the dangers of being outside. Even the active kids, there have been active kids that have been affected by this because you remember – your son is in hockey. Your daughter is in hockey. There was a hockey player from Minnetonka that suffered frostbite last week when his team and when Minnetonka was playing Andover at the Hockey Day Minnesota celebration in Bemidji when they were playing in the morning. He suffered from frostbite. He had to miss a game or two.
Wow. Okay. So I hope he's going to be okay. I know we were actually looking into that story in our newsroom. I hope he's going to be okay because that can be – I mean, that's serious. That is a very serious thing. And I know that a lot of those kids, you know, I know some kids that don't skate with socks on or very thin socks, you know, and you think about being in that kind of weather and that's really, really tough stuff. So I do think that people just need to be careful and, you know, listen to the weather forecasts and bring all those, you know, that safety kit in your car if you have to be driving long distances. Maybe carpool because it is super cold. I know that it's Minnesota. I know that we are hardy and I know that we're ready to deal with it. But this is the stuff that's really tricky. And I do think it would be responsible as a parent to have the schools. I know they don't like to do that, but I think just when it gets that cold, I just think it's better for everybody. But that's me on my little soapbox. But we'll be working though. We'll be working. Listen, we've got a great show lined up for you. There are a number of very interesting issues at the legislature. Among the proposals that gun control advocates are talking about is a red flag law. And when you hear this, you think this really sounds like it makes sense that if you have a person who is not well mentally or is acting erratically, you would report them or there'd be some kind of mechanism for them to no longer have access to their weapons. The difficulty here, though, is how is that going to be administered when you think about it? I mean, I think that that's what's very tricky. We're going to talk with Senator Ron Latz about that, and we're also going to be talking in the 7 o'clock hour with Lexi Reed Holtum. She is the executive director of the Steve Rumler Hope Network, and I've worked with her on a number of things. I've chaired their fundraiser, and there are some very interesting proposals that are being backed by two very important legislators, Senator Julie Rosen, who's a Republican, and Senator Chris Eaton, who's a Democrat. And they are joining forces to try and create some change and awareness about the opioid crisis here. So it'll be interesting to hear from Lexi, because Lexi, she's been pushing this and talking about the need for improvements and changes to laws, and she's gotten laws through. This organization is really wonderful. So that's our 7 o'clock hour. 8 o'clock, we're going to chat with Dave Schultz. And oh, my goodness, where do you start? There's so much to ask him about. But coming up in this half hour, we're going to talk about the flu with Chris Ayersman, who is the director of infectious disease epidemiology at the Minnesota Department of Health. She really is the expert on this. And apparently this flu is widespread. This year, I did get the shot. Last year, I didn't. And I didn't get sick. But an awful lot of people I know got very, very sick, people who are ordinarily healthy. So it is 6:15. It is 5 degrees. We are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be joined by Chris Ayersman. It is 6:17 in the Twin Cities. Well, I don't know if you heard, there's been a lot of news going on, but the flu is widespread throughout Minnesota. And in Wabasso, they had to actually cancel school because of the flu epidemic there. And we're joined now by Chris Ayersman, who is with she's the director of infectious disease epidemiology for the Minnesota Department of Health. She's the person we all turn to for interviews on this topic. So I appreciate, Chris, you coming on tonight and joining us.
Well, happy to be here.
Well, thank you so much. Let me ask you, you know, I think a lot of people were concerned about what happened last year when the vaccine was not that effective. Do you feel it's more effective this year?
Well, you know, one thing about influenza is it's really quite variable. So it's hard to say if we're seeing, a better season because the vaccine is more effective or just because it's just that kind of a season. I can tell you that last year, the effectiveness was about 40%, which obviously with our measles vaccine, we're at 97%. So
right.
We're a little disappointed with influenza vaccines. But nonetheless, it's still worth getting vaccinated, even though we don't have, you know, the really great effectiveness.
Right. What are you seeing this year?
Well, we're at widespread activity, as you mentioned, and we have not peaked here in Minnesota. What we're seeing is that H1 is the strain that is predominantly circulating, and so we don't see as many outbreaks in long-term care facilities, or it doesn't affect the elderly quite as much as with some of the other strains, but we have seen a lot of school outbreaks. And just last week, we had 30 schools who reported outbreaks.
Wow,
so definitely seeing a lot of activity in schools, as you sort of alluded to.
Well, and Wabasso, they had to close the schools because it was so bad. I guess it's just that contagious.
Well, we definitely, you know, defer to the schools to make those decisions. And oftentimes they close schools because not only are the students sick, but also because the staff are sick. And so you can't run the school if you don't have the students and the staff.
Right. Absolutely. And it is something, you know, and last year there were, you know, when I know that the shot was not as effective, I do know some people who got the shot who did get sick. And the people I know who are in our newsroom who got sick got really sick. And it was, these are people who are, one of them is a lot younger than me. And she was so sick for so long. And it obviously can really be devastating and even deadly. And I think that's what sometimes people tend to forget.
Right. I mean, last year we had over 6,000 hospitalizations from, you know, individuals who had influenza. Thankfully, this year we're only at about 270 hospitalizations. So that's great. And we do see deaths. I mean, we've had 10 deaths so far this year. So, yeah, influenza can be really serious. And it's very much different from a cold, which, you know, you have your cough, you're sneezing, that type of thing. When you have influenza, you have a fever. You have aches, chills. You're out for 3 days to a week.
Right.
So absolutely what your colleagues experienced, that was right. Influenza.
Yeah, I mean, these are healthy people, and they were flat on their backs. They said they couldn't move. I mean, it was just – it was that bad. Is it still time – can you still get a flu shot?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's never too late to get a flu shot. And one thing to keep in mind is that some seasons what we see is we'll see a particular, like influenza A, and that'll be the predominant strain earlier in the season, and that'll sort of peak. And then as the season progresses, and we call the season from October to May, we can see a different strain start to peak later in the season. So definitely, yes, it's definitely still worth getting a flu shot.
All right. And I guess for many people there is, and I know people such as yourself say it's a myth, but there are some people who really are convinced that if you get the flu shot, you're going to get sick.
Yeah. You know, the vaccine has a killed virus, so it can't cause influenza. But I think what people get mixed up with is that when you get vaccinated, your body does mount an immune response, which is what you want. And sometimes that can mean that you feel, you know, a little bit, you have like a low-grade fever, you feel kind of a little bit achy for, you know, a day. That's your body actually responding to the vaccine. So that's actually a really good thing. And it's definitely much better than being flat on your back for 7 days.
Okay. We're chatting with Chris Ehrsman. She's the director of infectious disease epidemiology at the Minnesota Department of Health. Let me ask you, when you talked about last year and how sick people got, which is something that I saw with people I know, are some flu seasons, do they make you sicker? And I'm not phrasing that very well, but in other words, was last year particularly bad for those people who did get the flu? And is some years, even if you get the flu, you're not quite as devastatingly sick?
Yes. That's
if I'm making any sense at all.
No, that does make sense. Depending on what strain circulates, you can have a situation where it's a much more severe season. Not only do we see more people getting sick, but we see those individuals getting sicker. And last year was a great example of that because, as I said, we had over 6,000 hospitalizations. That's more than we had during the pandemic in 2009, 2010. So that was a season definitely in which the strain that was circulating was causing really significant disease. This year, we're definitely seeing influenza circulating, but we aren't seeing it, at least in Minnesota, at that really severe level at this point.
And when is it, can you, you know, people, you know, public health experts such as yourself, when is it that you can say, aha, well, that vaccine was only 80% effective or 50% effective or 40% effective?
Well, generally, we have to be farther into the season. So, you know, as there's studies that are going on right now that are being conducted to look at the vaccine's efficacy in this flu season. But we generally don't have that information in the middle of the season. What we can do is we can look at what strains were in the vaccine and what strains are circulating. And if those match, then that's definitely, you know, a very good thing. But you really have to wait until all the data come in from the season before you can make a statement about how effective the vaccine happened to be in that season.
Okay. And then one thing, and it didn't used to be this way. I mean, really, you can get the vaccine in so many places now. I mean, I think all of us go to Target or Walgreens or even Cub, you know, several times a week. You can get the shot there. Is it just as good? I mean, is it all the same as opposed to getting it at your doctor's office? I mean, I've heard people wonder that, and I said, I don't know, but I've got Chris Ehrsman on and I'll ask.
No, absolutely. It's the same vaccine. For individuals who are, you know, seeing their healthcare provider on a regular basis or may have an underlying health condition, you know, it certainly makes sense when you're in for one of those appointments to get vaccinated. But if you're one of the healthy adults that, you know, may not see your provider, you know, right during the time that we recommend vaccination, then any of those, you know, sort of non-traditional sites in the community are wonderful. My family, we made it family fun night, and we did get our vaccines at, you know, a community site.
Okay, so, and did the family fun night go over? Or you do something fun afterwards?
Actually, my family knows what it's like to be with someone in public health, so they recognize that for us that is a fun night. But for most people, they might not call it that.
And then also, I know that in the past, and now my kids are older, but I know in the past for some children, you know, getting these vaccines is just tough, and they really, it's and a lot of parents kind of go for the nasal mist. But I've heard there have been some years I feel like where the nasal mist hasn't been as effective. I mean, do you feel that that's just as good?
Well, you know, the last couple of years, the nasal mist wasn't available because there were some concerns about its effectiveness. And those concerns were addressed, and so now it is available again. And I think it serves as a really great option for kids and some adults. You can get it, you know, into adulthood who really don't like shots. It's a really good option. And so, yes, we definitely, you know, encourage parents to use that as an option if their kids are, you know, particularly concerned about shots.
Right. And you mentioned that there were 30 school districts where there have been outbreaks, and of course, Wabasso, they had to, you know, cancel schools. Is there any advice you have for parents and maybe some kids who might be listening? Because obviously you've got kids, especially I've got a high schooler, you know, who they're up late, they get up early, they're doing sports, they're doing drama, they're working so hard, they're a little bit, I think a lot of them are run down. But obviously they're all together, they're you know, eating. It's one of the great things about, you know, being school, you're with your friends. What advice do you have for parents of school-aged children about what to tell your kids? Hopefully they might listen to 1 ounce of what you say, but what is there anything they can do? Obviously, probably washing your hands.
Right, absolutely. I think, well, one thing you can do is you can say, hey, I know you don't think shots are the, you know, the most fun thing to do, but it's going to make it more likely that you're going to be able to go to those sporting events with your friends. You're going to be able to, you know, not miss your theater practice, all of those things. So one thing certainly is we'd encourage them to get those kids vaccinated. But the things that we talk about, you know, to help reduce your chance of acquiring flu are, one, you know, as you said, good hand washing. We tell people stay home if you're sick.
And
you know,
that's a biggie. Yeah.
Yes, we tend to do what we call presenteeism, where we go to work, we go to school no matter what. But all that does is, you know, share your germs with someone else. So we really encourage people to stay home when they're sick. You know, drinking plenty of fluids, getting good rest, eating nutritiously. I mean, all of those things that are going to help you stay healthy all year long are particularly important during flu season. And then, of course, you know, the respiratory etiquette, coughing into your elbow, you know, so that you're making sure you don't shake hands with your elbow. That by doing that, your chances of sharing those germs are much less. So those are all things that we, you know, recommend. But definitely, I think vaccine is the most specific tool that we have.
And don't share your water bottles, players.
Water bottles for so many reasons. But yes, absolutely. That's something to think about, too.
All right. Well, Chris Ayersman, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for your insights tonight. And obviously, and when do you update? You update it weekly. I know that, right?
Right. Every Thursday, we update the data. So if people are interested in kind of tracking how the season's going, you can go to our website and you'll get the latest data.
It's the Minnesota Department of Health. Chris Ayersman, thank you so much.
Sure, you're welcome.
Always a pleasure. She's always a pleasure to interview and always does a great job of kind of bringing the scientific stuff down to earth for the rest of us to kind of figure out. All right, well, it's Esme Murphy along with Jonathan Lowe, and we're just chilling here. Maybe that's the wrong word to use, but we're warm. We're toasty here in our studio. We got to take a break. Do I have to give the weather, Jonathan? Okay, Jonathan's going, yes, he's a thumbs up. All right, I'm going to give you the weather. And then when we come back, we'll be joined by Senator Ron Latz, who is pushing a red flag gun law. And at the surface, this sounds like a no-brainer, but I'm curious about how it actually would be implemented. So keep it right here, folks. You are listening to News Talk 830. It is 6:37 in the Twin Cities. We are at 5 degrees. And it's going to get colder. We'll have the forecast at the top of the hour again. But let's focus on some of the things that are going on at the legislature. There does seem to be an energy over there. People saying that they are going to get some significant bills passed this year. I know things have gotten stalled. And one of the efforts we saw last year was a surge in people demanding some kind of changes in Minnesota gun laws. And I thought one of the most interesting proposals was a red flag gun law that lets family members or police get a court order to temporarily remove firearms from a person who may be a threat to themselves or others. And what I think is so interesting about this is that I do think that there is some common ground here. Maybe you don't like this proposal, but I do think among, you know, the gun lobby, amongst people who are concerned and want more gun control, people all over the spectrum feel that, that we've got to get guns out of the hands of people who really shouldn't have them. Senator Ron Latz is behind the red flag gun law, and he is joining us right now. Senator Latz, thank you so much for coming on.
Hi, Esme. Glad to be with you.
Absolutely. Well, listen, let me ask you, why don't you explain how your law would work?
Well, it would work when a family member or law enforcement or person in the household knows of another person that is under a momentary emotional crisis and is posing a risk of a danger to themselves or to others by virtue of the fact that they have firearms in their home. So they would have the opportunity then to seek a court order. A judge reviewing the allegations or the concerns and would decide if the statutory standards are met, basically that they're a clear danger to themselves or to others and that the risk is imminent. On an emergency basis, they could get an order out the door very, very quickly with an ex parte petition, meaning just one side making a petition. And then the court could order the firearms removed from the household. And then the person who owned the guns could go in and ask the court to do a full evidentiary hearing to check and see if there really is such a concern. And that order would expire within 14 days after it was issued. The alternative, the non-emergency version, would allow for a petition to be followed by a hearing first, and then the court could make the decision.
So you have two different versions of this. One would be a temporary hold.
Correct. One would be lasting no longer than 14 days without having a hearing. If there were a hearing within the 14 days, then the court could decide to extend the order from anywhere from 6 months to 2 years.
Okay. Does anybody else have this law? Any other places in the country?
There are 9 or 10 other states
really?
That have this now. Yeah, Maryland being the most recent one to take effect. The sheriff of Montgomery County in Maryland just issued a report following its first 3 months in existence. And they have gotten orders to remove firearms in 148 cases out of 302 petitions, which means the judges were scrutinizing the petitions very carefully, and in more than half of them decided there was not enough basis to issue the order. In the other half, there was enough basis for the order, and about 60% of those petitions were brought by family members who one might presume would know most closely what emotional condition their family members are in. And importantly, the Montgomery County Sheriff noted that in 4 of those cases when the firearms were removed, there was a significant danger to schools in the area, that the person with the firearms was apparently expressing some interest or desire or plan to go cause harm in a school.
Well, let me ask you this, because, on the surface, I think, as I was saying, I think everybody wants to get the guns out of the hands of people who are mentally ill. That being said, are you concerned about scenarios where people could, perhaps for vindictive reasons or the wrong reasons, make some claim about somebody's mental health that wasn't true?
You know what I'm saying?
It just seems. And then who's to say who's mentally sound or mentally not? You know what I mean? I just wonder about the logistics of doing this, because on the surface, it sounds like such a good idea, but I wonder about the practicality of actually getting it and it working. And if, I can just see the person who's being the target of this saying, hey, listen, I'm fine. They're the ones with the problem.
Well, first let me caution in terms of the use of terminology. 97-98% of persons that have mental illnesses are not violent or not a danger to anyone around them. There is a thin sliver of those who are in danger of acting out because of their mental illness, and others who are just having severe emotional crises at the moment. I've just had a bad breakup with a longtime significant other, or going through a divorce, or just got fired from their job. You know, and not everyone reacts, you know, violently to those, but some people could, you know, go into a very negative reaction. And those are the cases that we're
right.
most concerned about. There is a provision in my proposal that would make it a misdemeanor crime. Someone could be put in jail for up to 90 days if they falsified an affidavit or if they were motivated by simple vindictiveness or harassing purposes. And so there's a strong incentive for people only to file a petition and to make statements, factual statements in their affidavit that are true, because they can be held criminally accountable if they falsify.
Okay.
So that's not to say that it won't happen on occasion.
Sure.
It does now in other contexts where we also have ex parte orders, protective orders, available in the order for protection in the domestic violence arena, in harassment restraining orders, in the non-domestic arena.
Yeah.
And that happens, but that's one reason why we have judges who have to make the evaluation, and also why each person subject to this such an order has a full constitutional due process right to an evidentiary hearing to determine whether or not the order ought to be issued or whether it ought to remain in effect.
Right. It certainly is an intriguing proposal. I know, obviously, the gun lobby at the Capitol is a very powerful one and certainly has been very effective in previous years, specifically last year. I think last year really was I think there was a remarkable turnout by gun control advocates. There was specifically one group, Moms Demand Action Minnesota, which was a relatively new organization, and they held some rallies where the organizers said they were expecting 20 people to show up and they got 200. So there did seem to be a lot of interest in that, but various proposals got nowhere. Was there a red flag proposal that was brought up last year? Did you bring this up last year?
There was, yes, and we were unable to get a committee hearing on it, and we were unable to get a floor vote on it in the Senate. We had a procedural vote, but not on the merits. You're right. Last year, there was a lot of grassroots energy behind this, but I think a lot of legislators hadn't seen that translate into challenging their ability to remain in office. However, this past November, we saw a lot of elections, particularly in suburban districts for the House, turn in part on these kinds of issues. Voters are beginning to make decisions on who to vote for based upon the candidates' positions on measures designed to reduce gun violence, not just on the other side of the equation, on measures, you know, someone who's strong enough supporter of the Second Amendment. And I really want to emphasize, if I may, Esme, that there is full due process available in this case, or in these cases. That's one of the things that the opponents of this are saying, oh, we'll take the guns away without due process. Well, our Supreme Court has recognized this process in driver's license revocations, in orders for protection in a domestic scenario, where you can actually remove the person from the home, not just the guns.
Right.
You can actually remove a person, and you can do it on the basis of an ex parte judicial order with a prompt right to have a full evidentiary hearing shortly after that order takes effect.
Well, that's fascinating. I'm chatting with Senator Ron Latz, who has a red flag bill that would allow family members or police to get a court order to temporarily remove firearms from a person who may be a threat to themselves or others. I was not aware that if you have concern about perhaps somebody who has a driver's license who shouldn't be driving, can you go to the police or begin a process to get them have their license taken away?
That's not exactly the process for that. But if you are arrested for a DWI, even before there's a conviction, your driving privileges get removed. And then you have a right to petition the court for a full hearing on whether or not the driving privileges were lawfully removed.
I see. Well, let me, and then also there's, I know another push is to close what some people say is a loophole. Certainly the gun lobby disagrees that it's a loophole, to require background checks for all gun sales, even those that take place at gun shows. Although there doesn't seem to be a push for person-to-person sales within the family, like, for instance, a grandfather could, you know, gift a gun to a grandson or a son. What do you think about that proposal? Does that have legs?
Yeah, that's the other bill that I'm carrying. Let me just first say on the red flag bill, there's a lot of suicides, especially in greater Minnesota. It's the greatest cause of death in Minnesota. And the red flag bill is designed in part to help prevent people from acting suicidal and taking their own lives. But with regard to the background check bill, there are a number of exemptions in there for transfers between family members, between friends who are hunting together, as long as they're still hunting together, for loans to friends who want to go hunting for a limited period of time, you know, for law enforcement agencies that are exchanging firearms between co-workers and so on. So there are a lot of exemptions in there. But the biggest point is to close the existing loopholes where private-to-private sales are done right now. And these are 40% of the transactions in Minnesota. Private-to-private person sales are done without any kind of a screening to determine if the person receiving the gun is, under current law, not eligible to have that gun, meaning they've been convicted of a violent felony. They've been convicted of a domestic violence offense, that they've been convicted of within the last 3 years of a Chapter 152 drug offense, sale or possession. What if they've got a known history of actually using unlawful drugs under Chapter 152? And we don't have any of that screening. And a lot of these sales are happening around the edges of gun shows. They're happening through Craigslist connections where the people get together in a parking lot at a retail establishment and exchange, you know, the money and the firearm. This is all done without any background check to determine if the person getting the gun is lawful in receiving that gun. That's a loophole that we're trying to close.
Yeah, let me ask you, and you, I mean, you know the Capitol. You've been there. You've pushed for these kinds of measures before. What do you think the odds are of something actually getting passed this year?
Yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic that if we get a vote on the Senate floor, that we will have the votes to pass it, meaning at least 34.
It mostly splits along party lines, but not necessarily. And there is a one-seat majority for the Republicans in the Senate.
There's an open seat also.
Oh, there's an open seat. That's true.
13. So that one is still being worked out. But there will be a very close divide in the Senate. And it's not necessarily partisan. It's more greater Minnesota and urban Minnesota, you know, where the divide is. But especially in suburban Minnesota, where a lot of these seats flip from Republican to Democrat. Now, there are a lot of senators now who have DFL House members that they didn't have before because their districts are changing and their districts are starting to vote on this issue. So I think that when we take the kind of moderate approach that my proposals are, and you look at the goals here to avoid, we're not trying to create a registry, and the bills that I've proposed will not create a registry of firearms. There's full due process for all of these here. The background checks are very simple. They're built upon the existing permit to purchase or transfer repurchase statutes. We're not making anyone ineligible that isn't already ineligible. It's current law. All we're doing is finding a way to screen out the people that shouldn't be allowed to have the firearms. And at no charge, by the way, to the buyer.
Right.
They would get an annual permit. There would be a monthly electronic check of all permit holders by the law enforcement agency just to make sure that they haven't recently been convicted of something that would make them ineligible to possess that firearm and disqualify the permit. And the permit issued under the Senate bill would last for a whole year, and they could purchase an unlimited number of firearms. So So no restrictions of any sort like that. All we want to do is to be able to screen the background of the person who's getting the permit.
Well, listen, Senator Ron Latz, thank you so much for taking the time. I'm sure that we will be following this throughout the legislative session here, because obviously this made a big splash here. A lot of people are talking about these bills. And while there was not these bills did not really get very far last year, there's some indication that with the new change in terms of the House being Democratic, with the situation in the Senate, this could be the year. And certainly the governor sounds like he is on board with some form of measure of one of these proposals passing. So, Senator, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it tonight.
Esme, I appreciate your time. And these bills are going to save lives. The data is showing that. In states with background checks, they've cut in half the number of domestic violence deaths, officer shootings, the data on the red flag bills are reducing suicides substantially. So these bills will save lives, and I'm hopeful that we can get a hearing and a vote on the merits this year in the Senate.
All right. Well, listen, Senator Ron Latz, thank you so much, and stay warm this evening. Stay warm through the next week as well, too.
You too, Esme.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, folks, we have to take a break. A fascinating discussion on how that would work, because I think at one level, I think that makes sense to everybody. It's the implementation. But it's interesting that he has that part in his bill that would make it a crime to make a false statement about somebody's a capability of having a gun. All right, folks, we're going to take a break and much more ahead on News Talk 830. There is much more ahead on this Saturday evening. Coming up in our next half hour, I'm going to chat with Lexi Reed Holtom. She's the executive director of the Steve Rubler Hope Network. It's a great organization that does so much to help spread awareness and also pass new laws to help battle opioid addiction. And I want to talk to her about some of the proposals before the legislature this year. This is very interesting. 7:35, we're going to chat with a young man who has founded a company called Thrifty Traveler. And he was a guest on WCCO's 9 a.m. show this week. And I was like, I'm getting you for radio because I want more time with you, because he really has some great ideas on how to get great deals and how to tailor it to you and where you fly from. All right, folks, keep it here. You are listening to the one and only News Talk 830. Back after this.